Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of November 16th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Jay. How are you doing?
Great. We had a spectacular geomagnetic storm last week that not only lit up the night sky, but it also lit up social media. Fantastic pictures as well of the Northern Lights, as well as lots of novice questions and some questionable information out there. So Mike and I have discussed that in a little bit more depth in our topic today. And so let's get Mike's space weather forecast for the next few days. Mike?
Yes, Jay. So we have been receiving solar flares from sunspot 4274 for the last week, and that's what produced the fantastic display. That sunspot has now turned away and is on the far side of the sun, so we are no longer in the strike zone. And the most recent flare and CME that it released did miss the Earth. So we are pretty much at the end of this round of solar flares from that very, very active sunspot, unless it continues to be active when it comes around again. But we've got a bit of a reprieve here, and our chance for solar activity has diminished accordingly. Here in mid-latitudes, we have 35 to 40% chance of active conditions over the next 48 hours, diminishing down to only a 5% chance of a very severe condition. Up at higher latitudes, however, there's still some solar wind and chance of severe storm between 55% for the next 24 hours and 65% for the next 24 to 48 hours. So if you are at a higher latitude, you may have a better chance of seeing the Northern Lights. So we do want to return to this topic and talk more about the geomagnetic storms and what we captured and discuss them in a little bit more depth. But for now, I want to see what else is going on in the night sky this week, Jay.
Well, tonight, we turn our attention to one of the most famous annual celestial events, the Leonid Meteor Shower. This spectacular display, which runs from November 3rd through December 2nd, is set to offer viewing opportunities in the dark hours between late tonight, November 16th, and dawn tomorrow, November 17th. The predicted peak of the shower is actually at 1800 hours universal time tomorrow, UTC time tomorrow. If I do some quick off my head math here, let's see, minus 7 off that, so that should be about 1100 hours. So 11 tomorrow was when it peaks. Of course, that'd be actually be during the daylight here in Mountain Standard Time. But before and after this time, it will offer the best terrestrial viewing. The Leonid's radiant, the point in the sky from which the meteors appear to stream, rises around midnight and is highest in the sky just before dawn, making the pre-dawn hours the ideal window for catching shooting stars. So stargazers are in luck this year as the new moon falls on November 20th. So that'd be next Wednesday or Thursday, meaning that the slender waning crescent moon will pose no significant light pollution, allowing for truly dark sky viewing. Under these ideal conditions, you can expect to see a rate of about 10 to 15 Leonid meteors per hour. While the Leonids are reliably active every November, they are best known for periodically producing breathtaking meteor storms, most famously doing so in 1966 when observers reported thousands of meteors per minute. These extraordinary outbursts are tied to the meteor's 33 to 34 year cycle. Although recent returns around the turn of the millennium didn't quite live up to the legendary 1966 event, the Leonids remain a must-see for dedicated stargazers. Even when the lion whimpers rather than roars, the experience of watching the Earth pass through this ancient stream of cosmic dust is a powerful reminder of our journey through space. Bundle up, find a spot away from the city lights, and look up to catch a sight of these fleeting streaks of light. And in space news, last week on Thursday, Blue Origin's New Glenn rocket successfully launched the Escapade mission toward Mars. This was after a weather delay on November 9th and a space weather delay on November 12th. The mission left from the Launch Complex 36 at Cape Canaveral's Space Force station in Florida. ESCAPADE stands for Escape and Plasma Acceleration and Dynamics Explorers. And the mission will use twin spacecraft, nicknamed Blue and Gold, to study Mars's magnetic environment. This was just the second launch for the New Glenn heavy launch vehicle after its initial launch back in January of 2025. I watched the launch on the Blue Origin News YouTube feed, and it was wild to watch as the reusable New Glenn booster returned and safely landed on the platform back on Earth. So that leads us to our discussion of last week's geomagnetic storm. So what did you capture there, Mike?
Yeah, maybe if I could just for 1 second, Jay, I want to back up to the Leonid displays that come out every 33 years. And I just want to mention that just how truly amazing this would be when it hits that, what they call not just a meteor shower, but a meteor storm. And 1833, I think, was the year that was the most dramatic. There were accounts of people who were, you know, drinking and playing cards, and somebody went outside to go to the bathroom and looked up and believed that they were witnessing the end times. And the card game ended, they stopped their drinking, and they ran to church because they truly believed the world must be ending. And that was not unique to just those one group of card players. That was an experience that a lot of people had. And I did read one account that said that between 5:45 and 6 a.m., estimates of 8,000 meteors streaking across the sky in just 15 minutes during that meteor storm. So it is my hope that in my life, I'm going to get to view a true meteor storm that is not necessarily an apocalyptic end times event. So,
yeah.
But to jump over to meteors, and I do believe, or to Aurora, I do believe that I've been spotting some Leonids over the last week or so, and I got a really nice shot of a Leonid, or a meteor at least, right during the Aurora display on Tuesday. I saw somebody call it the Armistice Day Storm, and I like that title for it. Mm-hmm. I got a text message, you know, at around 6:15 or so Tuesday evening, alerting me that from one of your neighbors down in Tres Piedras, that it was visible to the naked eye, and the sun had just set, so it was, you know, we were still in that twilight period, and I was with some friends for a game night. We suspended our game night, ran out onto the deck, and watched the display unfold in the north and northeast. And the first thing that I want to say about this is that, you know, I've seen with my eyes, I've seen Aurora about a half dozen times, including when I lived in Maine. And this was the first display where the color was distinctly visible to me. The sky in the north was quite red. I would say even, it had a bit of an apocalyptic feel about it. And we all agreed as we watched this, that it was, and it continued to, shift around, but it remained red for a couple hours. And then at points we started to see a band of green, greenish yellow on the horizon. Now the greenish yellow was the color was quite a bit fainter, but it was still sort of, yeah, I think that's green. It wasn't quite white. And so it was extraordinarily exciting to me to see, not just the pillars of light that I've seen in previous displays, but actual color. Red, orange, and then the greenish yellow band that was lower. And we'll include links to our respective time lapses, I think, in this episode's show notes, because it was just, I knew when I left my house Tuesday night, I knew there was a good chance. And so I set my time lapse cameras up before I left because I didn't want to miss anything. And in setting them up, I also knew that I could not predict what exposure values would really work well. Normally I want to go for with a moonless night, a high ISO, and for me it's usually a standard 10-second exposure. And I knew that my ISO might be too high, and that it would be actually kind of blown out. And in fact it was. And my group of gaming friends decided to come back to my house where I had a better view of the horizon. And the first thing I did was run out and turn the ISO down on my time lapse because it was just blown out. The last thing I'll say before I kick it back to you, Jay, is I had my second camera pointed due south. I thought, well, wide angle lens pointed north, I'll get the aurora display, and let's just see if something interesting happens in a different direction. As I so often do, I have to just pick semi-randomly where I'm going to point. And the thing that was really notable to me is that the foreground and the clouds to the south were illuminated red by the aurora display. So that color was so bright that it actually cast a red tint across the chamisa and grasses in the field to the south. So, how about you, Jay? What was your experience?
Yeah, I was very similar to yours. Is that I'd already set up my time lapse camera in anticipation for the aurora, and I thought there was a fairly good chance of it. But again, I'd set it up and actually didn't hit record because went in to eat dinner because it was still twilight and didn't expect it to appear quite so early. And so. And again, there was somebody on my social media that popped up and said, I'm seeing it. And so I ran outside and hit record immediately. And as soon as it came up in the viewfinder, it was, terrifically bright. And then I was seeing it with my naked eye as well. And so I, started it, the time lapse recording, and then ran it in the house and grabbed my wife Annie, and we both ran out with our phones. And even without, getting on a tripod and just using our old ancient iPhone 11 Pros in night mode, we were able to capture some pretty spectacular, still photos. And so I was just running around like a mad person with my phone, looking for, great vantage points, and taking photos with the phone, and then the first green appeared, and I posted on social media, "We've got green," because that's highly unusual down here in northern New Mexico that we get any other color than the red, and so. And actually, so there was people reporting that they were, we both live off grid, and so there was people that were reporting that they were actually getting voltage on their solar panels from the from the aurora. And so there was, and so I've got some bifacial panels, and it you know, I may be kind of deceiving myself, but I swear I was getting, you know, an extra, you know, 50 or, you know, 50 or so watts off of my panels just from the aurora. So, and then also I have to say that on, you know, and of course the forecast was that there would be even more spectacular on Wednesday, and so everybody that missed it on Tuesday, of course, was you know, saddling up to try to catch it on Wednesday. And of course Wednesday wasn't quite as spectacular as Tuesday, but it still was, you know, a fairly rewarding night to see the aurora. And on Wednesday is when I captured a great meteor with the aurora, and it was a meteor, again, you know, camera was facing north, so it was to my north, and it had a persistent ion trail, and so that was also in that time lapse. And my Tuesday time lapse, I actually submitted to our local Albuquerque news station, KRQE, and they were, you know, quite impressed with the time lapse, and they aired it on their noon newscast. And of course, they actually didn't have time to run it on their 5:30, their usual, you know, 5:30 main newscast PM. But that was nice to kind of see my time lapse up on their KRQE website, and to see it on air as well on the news. And so let's talk about, you know, there were, you know, my social media basically lit up with, you know, 100% of all these iPhone photos of the aurora. And so there were a lot of novices out there, and they were saying, why can't I see this with my naked eye, and I see it so well in my iPhone? So could you answer that question, Mike?
Jay, I think most of the folks who were unable to see it with their naked eye were in areas of greater light pollution. There was no question that even here in Southern Colorado, it was very visible, but we live in, you know, a Bortle 2 zone. And as you know, and you're down there in Bortle 1, 2 as well. And so I, you know, corresponded with several people in the Denver metro area, you know, who were north of us and who should have, by all rights, had an equally good view. They could capture it with their cameras, but not really see it. And I chalk that up 100% to the light pollution of the cities, or, you know, let's say 80% to the light pollution of the cities. And, you know, 20% will say that not everybody's vision is acute. You know, it really does pay to be in an exceptionally dark area for these displays. And it's worth, you know, heading out. One of my friends who does live in a fairly rural area, I texted him and I said, it's over in Kiowa on the other side of the Rockies. And I said, hey, you know, the northern lights are naked eye visible. He looked down and he said, oh, it's cloudy. Well, then he texted me back an hour later. He said, yeah, I took my daughter out. We drove out. We got out from under the clouds and we saw it, and it was magnificent. Thank you. So, you know, a display like that, it would have been worthwhile on Sunday night, or I'm sorry, on Tuesday night at sunset, to have, you know, left the city and driven out onto the plains or driven up into the mountains, you know, even half an hour, get just far enough away from the really bright city lights, and then you're going to start to see it.
Yeah, and so, yeah, and I wanted to speak a little bit about the, you know, how our vision works as opposed to how a camera's vision works as well.
Yes.
So, you know, our eyes, we have rods and cones, and then a camera has a sensor with what we call photosites. And so It's eluding me right at the moment, but which is it, rods or cones, that is most sensitive to monochromatic low light?
Rods.
Okay, so our rods are more sensitive to low light, and they are basically monochromatic. And so a lot of people, when they go out to look at the night sky, whether it be for the Milky Way or for Aurora, is that they're not really seeing a lot of the colors that they would see with a camera. And that's just simply because, you know, the cones are not actually getting excited. There's not enough photons to excite the cones and discern color. Whereas a camera sensor, whether it be an iPhone or a more sophisticated camera like your Sony, is they actually have to put a filter on those sensors to make them see in the spectrum of our visible light. Camera sensors are engineered in such a way that they actually capture more of the electromagnetic spectrum than our eye does. And they actually have a infrared filter that cuts down the infrared light for those camera sensors. But that being said, they're color agnostic as far as whether they don't have rods and cones. They have photosites that are mapped to be capture either red, green, or blue color. And a camera sensor, they're more sensitive to green because there's more photons in that part of the electromagnetic spectrum. But they're also very sensitive to red as well. And so that's why on the camera, when we aim it at the Aurora, which has a lot of red content into it, which is also the lowest energy, it's the infrared, our eyes don't capture reds very well. And cameras, on the other hand, actually have filters on them to cut down on the amount of red that they see. So that's one reason there, Mike. And so I don't know if that was a little bit too much in depth. And anything else that you'd like to say about, you know, comparing the human eye experience with the camera experience?
You know, I think that was a pretty good point to make, Jay, just that we have three different types of cone cells in our eyes that are tuned to short wavelength blue, medium wavelength green, and I believe that those are the ones we have the most of, and then long wavelength, which is red. There are some people with the mutation, primarily in females, that have four cone subtypes, and they have a condition called tetrachromasy that gives them a much wider range of color vision. And, you know, it's sort of a running joke sometimes that, you know, the men don't perceive the variations in colors that women do. And there's an actual biological reason for that. And also a reason why men tend to be more colorblind, being that some of these genes are, in fact, on the X chromosome. And because women have two X chromosomes, they have a better chance of surviving a defect in that gene. Whereas if men have a defect in that gene, they only have one copy of it. So that's why we tend to be more colorblind than women.
Mm-hmm.
There is another aspect to this that I'd like to discuss, though, Jay, if it's all right with you, and I'm just going to kind of wing this here for a minute. So I had an odd experience as I was looking at the Aurora display on Tuesday night, and I started to experience a visual distortion that I could identify very clearly as an ocular migraine, and it in the center of my vision I start to see this, you know, distorted wavy, you know, pattern. And mm-hmm. And I knew that I wasn't seeing an actual thing in the sky, because when I turned my eyes to my cell phone and looked at my cell phone display, the disturbance persisted. So it was there when I was looking at the aurora. It was there when I was looking at my cell phone. And I didn't think much of it, but it was a prelude to a headache that lasted for about 3 days. I actually took Thursday and Friday off work. It was bad enough. This reminded me that there is, somewhat explored link between some autoimmune diseases and geomagnetic activity. And we'll include a couple links to this in our show notes today. But rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis, giant cell arteritis, all linked to solar cycles and solar storms. Multiple sclerosis is interesting in that they've observed that there is a higher incidence at in the populations that live at higher geomagnetic latitudes. And the first thought is, oh, high latitude, you're not getting enough vitamin D. Maybe this is a vitamin D deficiency. But the incidence rates are actually correlated with geomagnetic latitude, which varies. The strength of that field is not equal by latitude lines. And the places with stronger geomagnetic fields seem to have higher incidences of multiple sclerosis. So, there's not a definitive correlation here. And I will just say that I don't think that my headache was necessarily caused by, the storm itself, except incidentally, I think I was so excited and I was straining my eyes so intently that I think I just really, I was had my eyes wide open and my neck craned up for a couple hours, and I think that I just overdid it, and that the headache was mostly tension headache, and that I probably pinched some muscles in my neck. So I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that I'm blaming the solar storm directly for my symptoms, but I think indirectly my excitement over it led me to injure myself slightly.
If I get the migraine aura, it's usually in a high contrast lighting situation, and I'm fortunate enough that I only get aura. I don't really have a headache, but I do occasionally have that migraine aura appear, and I didn't I don't think I had it one last week, so
Yeah. Well, it occurred to me I was looking up, straining, watching, and then I was looking back down at my phone to, notify more of my friends, hey, you need to go outside and look at this. And so I was looking at a fairly bright cell phone screen and then up at the dim sky. And so my eyes were just continually readjusting to those conditions. And I think that it was the combination of of things that triggered my experience. But I'm going to ask a few friends with autoimmune conditions whether they noticed any recent flare-ups out of this.
And so and another thing that we kind of should talk about a little bit. Well, I think we've talked about it a little bit in the past that we actually during geomagnetic storms that we actually experience less cosmic rays hitting the Earth, or we can detect less cosmic rays because when we're getting these this ejecta material from the CMEs hitting our atmosphere, that excitation is actually helping shield us from cosmic rays from other stars out in the universe. And so we're getting all the radiation from our own sun, which is actually kind of acting as a shield front to repel cosmic rays coming from out of the solar system.
That's right. Actually, a paradoxical protective effect from a CME.
And so are we actually experiencing more radiation to our bodies when during a geomagnetic storm?
I don't believe that's the case, but I would need to double check on that and get back to you. Most of what we are seeing, the radiation is going to come during the initial X-ray burst, right? And that's going to come 8 minutes after the flare erupts. The CME is going to come a lot later. So You know, the difference between the speed of light delivering the radiation to us and the CME, which is, you know, traveling much slower because it is matter and not just pure energy.
Yeah, and I think it probably you know there probably is some elevated levels because you would think you know when they some of the studies I've read about Mars's atmosphere and the fact that that Mars doesn't have a significant magnetic field has led to its having less protection from CME radiation and from X-ray radiation what do you call it? X-class flares. So that's an interesting issue, and you know, and of course, there's the reports of you know that astronauts have experienced where they actually kind of see cosmic rays hit their eyes when you know that they experience these sparkling effects and from when a cosmic ray actually passes through their eye.
Yeah, I occasionally get that on my camera sensor too.
Yeah, that's just one of those you know rare things that you know that we could ex experience when we put out these time lapses. You know, one of the things not only do we you know when I s initially started doing time lapses and viewing the night sky and photographing the night sky, it was like I just want to catch the Milky Way. You know, I've you know seen all these spectacular pictures of the Milky Way, and I want to just capture the Milky Way. And oh, by the way, I might be able to capture a meteor or two. You know, and you know, I thought, well, you know, the Northern Lights—that's for people that are in Alaska or Sweden. And so, you know, this has been a very rewarding experience in that, you know, not only have I been able to see the Milky Way and the colors of it, and experience meteors in ways that I hadn't anticipated. And I credit you, Mike, for educating me quite a bit on a lot of these night sky phenomena. Is you know I had never seen a persistent ion trail from a meteor before you'd captured one and showed it to me. And then of course then I was able to keep an eye out for them and see those in my photography. And then you know, and then we talked about aurora. The first time I captured an aurora in the night sky, and that I thought that was fantastic. And then there were some other phenomena that again, Mike, you introduced me to, is that I had no idea about gravity waves, and I had no idea about Steves and some of these other atmospheric phenomena that we experience, and most of these are due to ionic radiation in the night sky. And so I want to thank you for that, Mike. And we want to thank all of our listeners for checking out this podcast. Please be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. You can also check out our individual websites, which will have time lapses on them. At wildernessvagabonds.com and at skylapser.com, and of course on my Skylapser YouTube channel and the Wilderness Vagabonds YouTube channel. And if you'd like to help us out, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/skylapser. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky
wishing you all clear skies and bright aurora.